podde tillbaks igen. Linus på baslinjen. Ja, han är tillbaka igen. Linus på baslinjen.
Welcome to another episode of Linus på baslinjen podcast. Today with the former Danish player Fredrik Nielsen. Freddy Nielsen won the doubles title in Wimbledon 2012 and reached 17 in the world in doubles and 190 in singles. A few days ago, Freddy announced that he will retire and now work as a coach at the Danish Federation, mainly with their elite players during the step from juniors to seniors. Fredrik Nielsen is also the Davis Cup captain for Denmark. In this episode, I asked Nielsen about if he's satisfied with what his career turned out to be, what he have done well and what he might have had done differently with the knowledge he have today. We talk about his new position as a coach for the Danish Federation's elite section, if private initiatives is the way to become professional in Scandinavia. We talked about in what way he helped Mikael Ymer during a few years. And of course, we talk about motivation, short and long-term goals, and process and result-oriented mindsets. A great episode with a super interesting Fredrik Nielsen. So, yeah, please welcome Fredrik Nielsen to the show. Now, I'm super happy to be able to welcome Fredrik Nielsen to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Fredrik, just a few days ago, you announced that your playing career is over. Are you happy and satisfied with what your career turned out to be?
Yes, most definitely. When I started playing 20 years ago, I didn't even think I was going to be good enough to win one ATP point. And I hardly believed that I was going to be able to play for the amount of time that I have.
Yeah.
So I'm extremely pumped that I was able to have hold this lifestyle for this long and get the experiences that I had. So for me, it's been more than I could even imagine in my wildest dreams. So I've I'm looking back at it with very fond memories and some pride and a lot of happiness.
Yeah, cool. You became one of the best doubles player in the world and good in singles as well. What do you think you have done very well over the years that made you go this far with your tennis?
I enjoyed every single day and I was very curious as to how I could improve. Mm-hmm. And I think that hunger to try and find ways of getting better, plus the desire to find a way and enjoy every part of the journey has made me probably get more out of it than I thought I was going to be able to, because I was never very good junior. I was never very good coming up. Like I told you before, I didn't think I was going to be good enough to get one ATP point. So also that genuine love of the game has made me embrace everything about the situation, and never got too down on defeats, never got too high on wins. Nothing ever got in the way of enjoying the tennis life. So I was always able to have a great experience and enjoy whatever challenge it brought at the various times.
Was this like mindset something you learned during the years, during the career, or have you always, like you talk about how you enjoy every moment, you enjoy the ride, ups and downs, was it so from the beginning as well?
Yes and no. So I always enjoyed tennis, definitely, and the only reason I started playing was because I really loved it, and I was, like I told you, I wasn't even thinking that a professional career was in the cards. So at first it was just like, what, I can travel the world and play tennis? Oh wow. So I was just gonna do that, but but it also gave me a lot of anger the first few years. And I had some moments where I was thinking, why do I get so angry when I'm doing something that I love so much? So I did have to deal a little bit with that, but it was more kind of short term anger that affected the individual matches, and it never really put me off. But then as I progressed later on, and the older I got, the more I understood about myself, I got better at handling it, and I got more professional as well. And I had definite some big developments in my mental capacity and my understanding of what it requires to be a professional life, whereas the first few years I was just kind of playing. But that fundamental joy of the game and love of the life was always there.
Okay.
So in a way, yes, but at the same time, I definitely learned how to deal with it differently as time progressed.
And how did you learn that? Was it like, did you read books about it, or did you have like a mental coach, or was it like by yourself you were analyzing what was going on?
So in the first few years, we always had some coaches attached from the National Federation. We had a pretty good setup with the National Center. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of went along with what I was told and didn't think too much about it myself. I was just in the hamster wheel, going week to week and not really thinking too much about what was happening. And I was just doing what I was told and playing the tournaments and going week by week. And then the National Center ceased to exist, and I was more left on my own. And then I was forced, kind of by accident, to think about certain things. And when I was on my own, I started asking more questions of myself, such as, why am I doing this, or what's the point of this? And that started a thought journey. Mm. And in this particular period in time, I also met my mental coach.
Okay.
So he came in at the perfect time to cultivate all these thoughts that I've been having and all my ideas about what am I doing and why am I doing it. And I think that was very lucky that it came at that time. So he came as I was already trying to explore this area and kind of thinking what is the world of tennis for me, and why am I doing these things, and what does it take for me to improve, and why do I react in a certain way. And then he came in and really helped me to nail down what was important for me.
Okay. I know it's quite early after you have retired now, but can you see some things that you probably could have done differently with the knowledge you have today, but you maybe didn't have during the years on the tour?
Yes. So it's tough when you look back, because I was also, I never had that desire to really be number one in the world, top 10 in the world. It was a great lifestyle. I enjoyed it very much, which meant that I also enjoyed being home when I was away from the tournaments.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent all my, when I didn't play tournaments, I was at home with my family and my friends and was training at home. But it's very clear to me now that if I had wanted to be a better player, I would have had to take myself into a more competitive environment with higher level of training and sparring and opponents, and get myself a little bit out of the comfort zone to push myself to be better.
Mm-hmm.
Because in Denmark, I was one of the oldest there, and I was the highest ranked, and I was the best player in our training group. Christian Pless and Kenny Carlsen wasn't really part of that training group. So I felt like I was the one who was setting the level standards, and they were good compared to the group, but probably not great compared to the international world of tennis. And looking back, it's clear to me that if I had wanted to get better, I should have been in a more competitive environment. Also later on, when I have been in situations that could resemble a more competitive environment, I reacted very well to it.
Mm-hmm.
I like that. I like having demands set of me. I don't mind people pushing me and expecting a lot of me, and I like to be able to be in and around players where I gotta step it up and really be at my best to give them something out of the sessions as well, and rise to the occasion. So That's the one thing that seems pretty clear to me looking back, that that would have been a game changer. Mm-hmm. Had I been ready for it, or had I been, again, I wasn't very ambitious with my tennis, so I'm not sure that I would have been willing to invest that kind of money as well, because that would have been, I feel, if I had to move out of Denmark and find a training environment, it would have taken probably some money that I didn't have at that moment. And I'm not sure I was willing to back myself at that stage of my career.
In what age are we talking about here? Like, how old were you when you...
Early 20s. I think that's when it was would have made the most sense.
Okay.
So when I started to really understand what professional tennis was about, I was later in my 20s. And although I learned a lot, and it's given me a good platform for life in general, and it gave me some good years in tennis, it's still pretty late to kind of redevelop, discover what's important and how to be a professional when you're 27 years old. So I don't know, but and also moving away, I'm not sure I had that in me either, because I enjoyed being home with my family when I then was home. So it's very hypothetical. Looking back, if I had the knowledge that I have now, maybe I would have made the decision, but it's tough to say.
Okay. Right after you announced that you retire, Fredrik, it became official that you're hired as a coach for the Danish Federation's elite section from now on. What is the idea behind that position, and what do you hope to contribute to the players there and to Danish tennis?
So the idea is to help create a more professional environment for players to become professional.
Yeah.
And help set up an environment where it makes it easier from the transition from junior to adult tennis and be professional. We haven't had that for many years. Now we have an opportunity to improve that, and hopefully with time we can make it even better. Mm-hmm. So the idea for me is to try and use my experience and my many years on tour and having seen lots of different setups to try and create as good an environment for the players as we possibly can right now, and improve their chances of making a tennis career and a good life for themselves within the sport, and hopefully set up a system which is then well functioning and ready for when the next generations are coming through.
That step is quite interesting, I think, between the juniors and the seniors. Pretty difficult step for many of us. What do you think is important when going through those years from the juniors to the seniors? And what do you think?
Yeah, it is a very interesting. To help them with? Yeah, well, I think it is very important, and I think a lot of in juniors, people travel and play a lot. And I think that it's very important to try and get as close to a professional and an adult lifestyle as possible and as early as possible. Mm-hmm. And then have patience and play a lot of tournaments at the start of your career. Know what you're trying to do. Have a professional setup in your training. Make sure that there's continuity and that there's a consistent setup, and that you know what you're working towards. And then I use myself an example, who just went week by week the first few years, instead of trying to have the big picture of what we're trying to do with the players and then work towards it, because you probably also know that the average age of the professional tennis player in top 100 is pretty old.
Yeah.
So it takes some time before you break through, and it takes patience. So therefore, I think it's very important to focus on becoming the best version of yourself, and see what kind of tennis player you want to be, instead of thinking that you're just going week to week and trying to break through, because the chances of you breaking through, unless you're an extraordinary talent, aren't very big. So I think it's very important to try and make sure that the transition from junior tennis to adult tennis is as smooth as possible, to try and see that you're already in a professional frame of mind before you start playing what I call adult tennis, because if you're trying to compete at certain levels, you just waste so much time getting ready. I mean, if you're now you're playing at junior grade fours, and then you're ready for twos and then A's, and then you start all over with futures. I mean, it's just many steps instead of seeing, you know, what does it mean for me to be a professional tennis player, and then do that early on instead of trying to make results every week.
So you will have like a group of players that you will follow up quite closely then, or what's
Yeah, I'm responsible for the men's side.
Okay.
So yeah. Those are the ones that I will follow closely, and then I will be part of the daily training with the men and the women, and the juniors. But they have coaches that are their responsible person. Okay. But it's a fluid. It's gonna be in practice. It's gonna be a fluent environment. On the training, and then some people I'm more responsible for the men as well, because as I said, because I'm also a Davis Cup captain, so
yes,
so it makes more sense to make that red thread from a young age up into professional tennis.
Yeah, exactly. I wonder, in Scandinavia overall, my picture is that many of the top players have more or less come through private races. And we have Casper Ruud in Norway, we have Rebecca Peterson in Sweden. And from my understanding, Holger Rune and Tauson is more or less a private race as well. In your perspective, is Danish tennis built through like that you need to do it in private things? Or is there a good system to develop players, a good structure for it right now?
No, I don't think there is a particularly good structure for it right now, because it's very expensive to be a professional tennis player.
Yeah.
And that funding is just not available to make the players, you know, you were not like the French Federation or the Australian Federation or the American or the English. Uh-huh. And that goes without saying that some of these people, we can't do it without them doing it themselves. We can help. The system can help to a certain degree. But I don't think it's unfair to say that the majority of these people's progress have come from personal development. So they get a lot of assistance from the, I don't know what it's like in Sweden and Norway, but they get the help they can get from the federation, and whatever they need more, they do themselves, because they're proactive and they want to make their own career happen. I mean, Casper, I think it's a prime example for Scandinavia on how to do it. Went to Spain at an early age and has really, I think that, yeah, I think he's a prime example how to do it. And he's pretty young. He's cracked the top 10 almost, and if he hasn't already. And unfortunately, that kind of the way you should do it. Also, do we have a big disadvantage with the weather in Scandinavia? So I kind of feel like you have to get down south and play more outdoors in order to further your development. We can kind of get you somewhere and assist you on the way. But if you want to make it big, yeah, I agree that it seems like you got to go your own way most part. And how that is compared to all the other countries in the world, I'm not sure, but it certainly seems like we have a bit of a disadvantage in Scandinavia. It doesn't seem like we have the same kind of funding like the other countries. So it goes without saying that we can. I mean, if we could make full-time setups for these players, obviously we would.
Yeah, I see. If we go back to your own career, Fredrik, obviously one of the biggest moments was probably the Wimbledon title 2012. How was it to like win a Grand Slam title? Did it felt like a dream came true, or how was the feelings?
In the very moment, it was one big experience from start to finish. You know, it was just one big dream from when we got the wild card till we won. It was just very surreal.
Yeah.
It was one big, like when I think about Wimbledon, I don't particularly think about the moment we won it in the final. I think about the whole 2 weeks.
Okay.
As being a great experience. And it was pretty, yeah, of course it was. So therefore it didn't sink in that quickly after we won the final, because it was just an extension of the previous 2 weeks. And it wasn't until I had a little bit on distance that it started dawning on me what had happened. And it was a very particular, peculiar experience. I gotta say it was wild. It was a hell of an experience. It was in London, so very close to Denmark. I had a lot of friends and family came to come over and share the experience. I did it with Johnny, who's a good friend and a great guy to share it with. Mm. So mm. it was weird. It was kind of like a dream. It felt at some points it felt like it was meant to be.
Okay. You have told me before that you didn't thought that you were gonna get ATP points or maybe becoming a professional player. Was it still a dream to win a Grand Slam or play the Grand Slams for you?
Yeah, 100%. I wasn't thinking about winning. I mean, the first day we played first round in that year, it got postponed due to rain, and I was super happy because then I got per diem. Some extra money in my pocket because I stayed with my uncle for free. So the extra day of per diem was pretty substantial for me at that time. So that just shows you what my level of ambition was going into the tournament, that I got an extra day of per diem, you know. And I was just, I was over, until we played Wimbledon, I didn't think realistically or feel comfortable thinking that it was probably going to happen that I played Wimbledon. And maybe that's why it was such a good experience, because when we finally got to play, I was just so excited to get the chance to play. Mm. Forget about winning. You know, I used to walk by those courts when I was a kid. I traveled over with my grandparents, and I was watching as a fan, and I would go by and I would, you know, if there wasn't a match in the court, I would stick my hand in and touch the grass just to see what it was like. So it was... when I then finally got to play, it was basically a larger than life experience. So winning and losing was pretty far back in my head. The only thing I was thinking was to not embarrass myself so that Johnny would get shit for picking me for the wild card.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, I was literally thinking that just because I thought it was a little bit, it was nice for me, but it was also...
Did you feel pressure?
No pressure, but I just felt like it was a little extraordinary not to give it to a British guy who wasn't something, a big name, and I was obviously not a big name. So I was thinking that maybe I know what people talk in tennis part. So I was just hoping that Johnny in front of the Wimbledon committee or whoever gave him the wild card or the LTA wasn't going to look like a numpty for picking a guy who couldn't put a ball in the court. So that was my main concern, not to make him look like a fool, but I didn't feel pressure, no.
Okay. After the title, I know that many people asked why you kept playing singles as well when you had that success in doubles. Can you explain why you continued to play singles?
It's fairly easy. I mean, my life was perfect the way I wanted, so why would I change it? Like I told you, again, I didn't have any idea that I was going to be a professional tennis player even when I started playing professional. And here I was, 10 years later, just won Wimbledon because of the decisions I took in my life. So all the decisions I made, all my experiences, all what I've done had led me to win Wimbledon. Why on earth would I change anything? You know, to me, it was just, this just proves that the way I live my life is the right way for me. And like people ask me to play doubles, and if I did that, it was probably because they thought I could win more money or win some titles and this and this. And people would do that in order to, I would assume, to think that they would improve their lives, or they thought that they would improve my life. But I didn't see any chance that my life could improve, only the opposite. So in my book, it would be like a degrade of my life. So why would I make my life actively go to do something that I know would make my life less? Not, it will of course not be bad, but you know, if why would I on this on life's airline, I was flying first class, why would I go down to economy plus? You know, it's it's still a fine seat, it's better than economy, but I'm on first class here. Why? My life is great. I wouldn't change anything. If I had won $1 billion in the lottery, I wouldn't have made any changes. It would be the same. So nothing was ever going to stop that.
Okay. You mean because you think playing singles is so much fun?
It's not so much about singles. It's about playing tennis. So it's not, it's also easy to put it up, singles against doubles. It's not a singles versus doubles thing. It's about playing as much tennis as possible. And when I play singles, I can play singles and doubles. And then I can play team matches and I can play Davis Cup. And I want it all. If I only play doubles, I only got doubles. And in doubles, there's not that much tennis. There's a lot of serve. There's a lot of return. There's a few volleys in there. But I always find that there's more actual ball striking tennis in singles, and I enjoyed the practice for singles more. And I could kind of, I could always compete in doubles at a decent level without spending too much time with it. So like, it's not, again, it was not singles against doubles as such. For many times I made the priority to go to doubles tournaments only, even though I was still playing singles. So it's not like I just didn't want to sacrifice any tennis for the sake of some financial benefit or whatever. And yeah, based on the last few years where I only played doubles, like, I can see now that I'm not, that I ever was doubt, but it's just I have the evidence now that it was completely the right thing for me.
How do you mean? Because,
well, I played doubles the last 3 years because after 2018 I stopped playing singles because that wasn't good enough for that's when they introduced the transition tour. I had zero desire to play under the transition tour, even that that was my limit. I was willing to do a lot of things, but playing on the transition tour when I was 35 years old was not one of them. And I was not high enough ranked to play challenges, so it's kind of okay, I pretty much figured I was done. So I had my point from Wimbledon 2018 semi-final and doubles. So my plan was to play until Wimbledon. And then when I lost those points, I would be low on ranking and then I would retire. And then I just started playing doubles for fun and traveled the world with my wife. And we made a really weird schedule. If you go back and see my schedule, you can see that it's pretty random. I was coaching at the same time, and we basically made our schedule based on where we wanted to go. And then after a month, I was basically being tourist. And then after Aussie Open, I was thinking, this is bullshit. Either I go or I don't. You know, either I try to make the best of it while I have it, or I don't play, because this half thing is nonsense. So I started trying a bit more. And because we had such a great year, me and my wife traveling around and seeing the world, and I was barely home that year. I wasn't in Denmark until March that year for the first time. And we got to see so much. And we did all sorts of things. So and I was new to doubles. So I said, okay, let me find a way to embrace it. And then I got a full-time partner later on that year. And I really enjoyed that process. I felt like it was a little bit like being back in singles, where we could have, I could work towards something. I had somebody to work for. But then in 2021, when he left me, I was left to what was more the regular doubles life of, again, week to week, and finding partners that I really liked, but I didn't feel like I clicked with on court. And then it became professional side, and basically everything I feared doubles was going to be. And it was about the points and getting into tournaments and finding a partner here or finding a partner there. And I didn't enjoy that particularly much. Mm. And I can see now that the way I think and the way my mentality works, it's very difficult to find somebody who can embrace that way of being as well. So I can see that it would have been difficult for me to find somebody to play full-time with as well. Mm-hmm. And the mixing of partners and all this and I can just see that I'm okay. I'm happy I did it the last 3 years. It was a bonus. I was supposed to be retiring, but I got a few extra years out of it. I felt like I played with house money.
Yeah.
It was a good experience. I don't regret it. But the last year I didn't enjoy it that much. So I'm really happy that I didn't do it earlier.
Mm-hmm. You came into the transition ranking here, and even in the end of your career about rankings points to get into tournaments and stuff. Have you thought a lot about points and rankings during your career?
No, not too much. The times where I have been thinking a lot about it are the times that I've been the least effective. Or in the best state of mind, because if that takes over, then, for example, there was a 1 year after Wimbledon where I was at almost 1 year after I was still kind of playing to justify my decision to not make a decision about doubles, and I was trying to win matches and to get points and keep a ranking so that I could justify towards other people that I wasn't wasting my time, which I obviously knew I wasn't. But that those times were always the times where I was having the least success. And success, I mean by experience in my life. So I never tried to get too caught up in it. Of course, I'm human. It happens from time to time. And a lot of it isn't irrational fear, but also at the same time, that year after Wimbledon, I did drop my ranking a lot. And I got, at one point, I got back to around, I think, 700, 800. And when I was back at that ranking, I was like, okay, I'm still alive. Nobody died. Like, what's the big deal? You know, it was the thought of dropping points and dropping in ranking was much more dangerous than when it actually happened. When it happened, it was just like, oh, so what? Mm. You know?
Mm. Because I think that's a feeling or a stress many players feel. It's easy to say that you should not care about it, but I mean, at the end of the day, people that are at the lower level of the ranking doesn't have too many points. So obviously every point counts, I guess.
Yes. It's a strange one, because I'm not saying that it's right or wrong. It was definitely not right for me, but a lot of people find motivation in it, and it works as their fuel. So if that's how they react well to it, then of course they should use that. Whenever I try it wrong, it's more if you have the right desire, if you have the right motivation, and if you are able to not become shackled by it, or if it becomes a fear of performing, then obviously it's wrong.
Yeah. And what was your motivation in your career?
It was the love of the game, always.
I
thought it was the greatest lifestyle in the world.
Okay.
I mean, traveling the world, seeing the world, competing with the thing I wanted to do the most, playing tennis. Trying to get better, always trying to express myself at a higher level, rising the levels, having those experiences where something went into to a higher level in a match, and the love of the life and the game is always what drove it for me. I was always passion motivated, which is also why the whole doubles thing was also not even close to being something that I thought about, because when I'm passions motivated and then starting making decisions motivated on finances or material stuff, then there's going to be a conflict. And I was very well aware of that. So it was never going to work for me. So I always tried to to do what I was passionate about.
I have understand from earlier interviews you have done, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you have always put a lot of emphasis on playing your game and follow your ideas with what kind of tennis you want to play. And I think you said something like that you don't like the expression of finding a way in a match to win it. Can you explain a little bit more about that?
Yeah, maybe maybe I said that. I think it was more about the way I see it is with about finding a way. I think it's more as I would rather win 10 matches more in a season than two more finding a way, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
So if I try to, for example, if I'm trying to master something,
yeah.
If you use football, for example, if Barcelona is trying to get good in tiki-taka,
yeah.
And every time they need a goal, they ship a tall guy up in the opponent's box and they just lump it in. Mm. They're not going to improve their level at tiki-taka. Mm. So how are they going to be able to trust tiki-taka in an important moment if they start lumping it in? And I see the same in tennis. So if I want to be an aggressive player, and I think that the best version of me is to be an aggressive player who tries to finish the points on my rackets, I don't think that it would improve my chances of getting there if I left that way of playing to find a way where I would try to make the other player play badly.
Okay.
To win one match, because I saw it so many times that I did it a few times. I won a few matches, and then when I played another match where I needed to step it up, I was not comfortable with it because my experience told me that, yeah, my brain can tell the difference between the different matches, and it can tell me to step it up, but my muscle memory can just remembers what I've done, and it's too slow. It's too slow to tell my brain. For my brain to tell my body to do something in the heat of the moment. Like you hit a shot and the ball is back within a second. So you got to be able to trust your instincts and your training. And if every time I faced a adversity, I checked out and did something else, then how am I going to be able to trust my training in the heat of the moment? And I think that was that's what I meant about it.
Probably.
If you're not able to trust yourself when the going gets tough, how are you ever going to improve that? And that's why I think sometimes losses can be beneficial if you try to stay tough, and you can always learn something from yourself. But and that's also, I think, what I meant also about it was that it's too easy to give praise to people who just fight, you know. So if you run around and making a lot of balls, people always praise you. You know, they say, oh, what a great effort, this guy, he's fighting so much and he's running. And yeah, but if what he needed to do was hit winners, then I would rather see that fight of trying to hit winners instead of make balls and lose 3-3. And then if you were fighting, okay, you made it to 3-3 instead of 1-2, congrats, what's the point, you know? But that people are sometimes scared of the 2-2 losses where you didn't make many balls and you made a lot of mistakes because you were trying to go for it. But at the same time, you gotta ask yourself, what is my biggest chance of success here? And what's the benefit of fighting and fighting and fighting against a guy and trying to put a ball in and feel comfortable with my own performance, when the real challenge is to try and step up and do something out of my comfort zone. I gotta be more aggressive. I can't just lump in a kick serve to his backhand because he kills me every time. So I gotta do something else. And that's where I feel like that I would rather have, you know, a guy who fought with himself and had the courage to embarrass himself and lose 2-2 in 50 minutes, but trying to do the right thing instead of having this artificial praising of it's so good you run and fight. But why is that good? What is that gonna bring anything? And then in the next level is, of course, if you do the best and the if you play the way you want to do, and the opponent is so good that he asks you some questions where you have to find something else, that's fine for me, because like if you're giving him all you have and you're playing within your so it's not an active choice to, because you're scared of doing the right thing, then I think it's good to find a way. Like, you're not scared, you just, it's not working, you're still able to put the put your foot on the speeder if you need to, but it doesn't work. And I think that's where it came into, to actively go away from the right way of playing, to find a way because you're scared, instead of finding a way where you're doing everything you can and you're playing within your limits and you have all your repertoire, but the opponent is too good, then that's the difference, if you know what I mean.
Then you mean that you make a smart tactical change.
Yeah,
match.
Because it's still within, it's something that you actively try to do.
Yeah, yeah.
Instead of you're actively trying to avoid being courageous on the ball, for example.
Uh-huh.
And that's what I would always personally trying to play the tennis on my way and express myself. And it could be difficult because, first of all, my body language looks pretty weird on the court. So sometimes it looks like I don't care. Okay. And then I play on small margins. I play pretty flat. I try to hit the ball very clean. The best conditions for me are when it's as clean as possible, not too many bad bounces, not too much wind, good balls and all this. And
indoor in Scandinavia.
Exactly. There you go. And so not many very often it's like this, but that means that sometimes if I'm not really feeling it on today, it could look really, really bad.
Yeah.
But then that my line of thinking is it's in order to stay true to myself, I try to own the situation instead of the situation owning me. So if I let the situation get to me and I leave myself because I was scared of this situation, then I just become a victim of circumstance. And then it just depends on something that I can't control. Like, is the ball bouncing into my racket? Am I feeling good on the day? No, I want to be able to control this situation. So I want to be able to do the right things, even though I don't feel good. And that's basically what I was trying to do, instead of being reactive and just hoping, oh, I hope I hit the ball well today. No, I'm going to still do the right things, even though I don't hit the ball well. And I'm not going to be waiting for me to feel good. I don't want the situation to own me. I want to own the situation and still do the right things, even though it might feel strange on the day.
It seems, Fredrik, like you have quite strong viewpoints of how you want to play your tennis. How did you want it to be coached during your career?
I wanted to have a high demand set of me.
Like,
I wanted people to expect, I wanted my coaches to expect a lot of me, and I wanted obviously them to encourage me to embrace this style of game, where sometimes it can be fantastic and sometimes it can be shit. And sometimes I make some weird decisions and sometimes it pays off and sometimes it doesn't. But I wanted that high expectation of very high expectation of my approach and my performance without having any expectations of the level. And I also wanted to be coached with a high expectation of the logistical part and if you will, the more professional side, because that was always my weakness.
Okay.
So for example, timekeeping or being diligent in the gym before or being diligent after. I always just wanted to play tennis. So that was always my weak side. And in a way, for lack of a better word, a little bit of a babysitter. because that was you know, it shouldn't be like that. But the fact of the matter is that was one of my weaknesses, and I liked when I was kept accountable on that side.
Okay. And now when you have coached for a couple of years now, but when you're a coach yourself now, how what kind of coach do you want to be and to be seen like?
Quite similar. I mean, I also want to have high demands of the guys. I think that what I always feel thinking back that I was quite good at understanding is that we have a limited time to be a professional tennis player. Mm. Athletes have a very short career span. I mean, probably in the 30s and you're done. Mm. So I was always very aware of not postponing things that needed to be done. Mm. Let's take an example of my second serve. I wanted to improve it. And I was very aware of, I got to start now, you know. Mm. I can't just, I'm going 5 weeks to Asia. Yeah, but start now. What do you want to wait until Asia? But then there's something else. And, you know, so I'm very, I feel like I want to inspire some urgency into the game. If something needs to be done, do it now. Mm. What are you waiting for? Mm. And I want to help the players express themselves in the way they want to be expressed. I want to try and find out what makes them tick, because I know we're all different. Mm. I don't want people to be like me. I want to be the best version of themselves. And if I'm trying to encourage a way of being that is not true to them, mm. even though I feel it's right, it's not going to get a good result either on the court or in the experience for the player. Mm. So I want to try and make the best environment for the player to express himself or herself and be the best version of him or herself. Okay. And then I want to be I'm big on the, like my friend in Denmark calls the low hanging fruits. Okay. The stuff that the logistics stuff, the stuff that I just told you about that I was bad at myself. You know, that giving myself good time to be thorough and do the injury prevention and do all the logistical stuff, the boring stuff. Mm. Because I can see that, you know, you need discipline in your life, and also just from a tennis point of view, mm. the creativity comes from discipline, and mm. It makes everything much more easy if you have discipline and you have the if you give yourself time to be proper, you know. Yeah. One thing that I got better at over the years of understanding is that things take the time they take. I'm not doing my morning mobility or my more warm-up routine to get through it. I'm doing it because it serves a purpose, so I gotta do it right. Mm-hmm. I didn't always manage that even at the end, but at least I had an understanding of it. And I think that's important to think that we're not just doing things to do it. We're doing it because there's a purpose and we want to do it properly. So nothing is more important than what you're doing right now. So make sure that you make the most of it. And then I think that creates a good platform to express yourself the best way on the court.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking like you said earlier, that different players is driven by different motivations and maybe works different with goal setting and mindset. Do you think that you as a coach will be able to adjust to different players' motivation that when it differs from yourself? Have you thought about that?
Yeah, I definitely do. Sometimes I'll fail 100%, but I do think I will be able to, because I feel like I'm able to have that empathy to try to understand what people try to do with their own careers, and I think that I'm able to, as a as a coach to, yes, of course, use my own experiences and try to guide them towards some what I think is the right way for them, but at the same time be the what if you will, the policeman of their own desires as well. Try to be the outside voice that is trying to encourage what they want themselves. And like I just told you before, I'm very aware of how difficult it can be to be a creative player, because it can look so bad, and there's so many reactive comments like, you should just put it in, or just do this, or just do that, and I think I can help people be comfortable with what they're trying to do, and encourage that style that they want to do. But like I said, if I didn't think I was gonna be able to, then I probably shouldn't get into the business. I should probably find something else to do. But I'm not saying it's going to be easy, and I'm not going to say I'm going to be flawless. But if I didn't have the confidence to think that I was going to be able to do it, I think it wouldn't be the right thing for me to take this job.
Yeah, I see. You have helped the Swedish player Mikael Ymer the last couple of years now. How did that partnership start from the beginning?
Yeah, it was pretty random. We met at a tournament in America and just kind of talked a little bit, and he's quite an asking player. He'll ask random people random questions, and I was one of the random persons that he asked random questions. And I guess he kind of liked what I told him.
Mm.
And then a few months later, he came. He asked me if I hadn't decided to try and help him with his game, and I thought it could be a fun project on the side. I told him, I mean, it's not going to be perfect. I'm still playing, and that's going to be my priority, and I'm going to see if I can fit it in. So I said, sure, if you're happy with that, and as long as I felt like it made sense for him, then I would do it. And then that's just how it came around. And then when it didn't make sense to continue anymore, when he needed more help, that's when we stopped, because when you're a top 100 player and you try to push to the next level, you know, it's quite a difficult challenge. So we made the most out of the time we had together. And we had a great time. And there you talk about like the coaching side again, a different character. I mean, if we talk about different characters, I think me and him are pretty far apart on the spectrum. And I really like that.
Yeah, was it a lot of discussions?
Like you said, but always good discussions. Mm. But also try to understand what drives him coming back to what you asked me before, I was very consciously aware of that part, that this is gonna be so different to my own experience, and that's why I thought it was gonna be such a great challenge.
Mm.
And I also liked him a lot, like as a person, so he's quite a funny guy to me. So I thought it was a very interesting project to be part of. Plus he was a very good junior who was trying to make it to the top.
Mm.
And for me, being not a very good player ever, to kind of dabble with the people who compete at the very highest level was very attractive to me as well, from a personal point of view. So, yeah.
Mm. What did you learn through that, through working with Mikael? What did you grow like in your own like coaching role?
Oh, there's so much. There's what to say at what time, how much information you can give. I mean, I think... And I was also well aware that this was going to happen. So I was already making that preparation for myself, that I think most young coaches or people who start something, they have a lot of enthusiasm and energy and they come in just firing. And I tried to limit it, of course, but of course that I'm going to give too much information too soon because I'm too eager.
Yeah.
And I was very aware of that, but I still did it anywhere. And trying to get you figure out ways to get through to a guy, because Michael took the, you know, for example, Michael, he had different ways of seeing the game. Mm-hmm. So the phrases that worked for me didn't work for him. So I would have to try and figure out how to communicate with him in a way that he would understand it to the max, because the most important thing is that the player is comfortable, and then the coach can take all the stress. Mm. And that's the most important part. And I learned a lot about the tennis as well. I mean, I've never been sideline with a guy who was playing at top 100 level and playing slams, and it was interesting to see the competition with the other top 10 players and see what that required and how players would react to certain things. And there was also a lot of things that I went in with the great best of intention that turned out to backfire. Mm-hmm. And when I look back, I was like, oh yeah, I can see I probably should have done that, but I had no way of knowing at the time. So okay. So there's a lot. I mean, with everything, it's just a lot of experiences. Without going into too many details, it was basically mainly the communication, what to say when and in what way.
Are you still in touch? Like, do you still help him?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. No, I mean, we stopped at the end of 2020, but we stay in touch. I still consider him my friend. I helped him out now in Australia because he was alone for the first 2 weeks. Mm. And I always root for him. I follow his results and hope he does well. Mm. And like I said, I consider him a friend and funny guy, so I always want him to do well.
Mm-hmm. Great. Fredrik, we will finish up with two different topics that I would love to hear you elaborate a bit about and maybe tell us how you have worked with it during the years. And the first one is the short and long-term goals. Have you how did you work with the goal setting during your career, and what do you believe in there?
Yeah, so I believe that you have to have a big goal. Mm-hmm. Because that big goal is going to determine how you make your small goals. So what is your ambition if are you going to be number one in the world? Are you going to be top 10? So my ambition was to try and my big goal was to be a top 100 player. Mm. So then being a top 100 player, what does that mean for me? If I want to be a top 100 player, what does that mean for me in the small term? So every time I had a decision to face in the short run, I could always go back to the big goal. Does this get me closer to top 100? Mm. Yes, then I do it. Does this get me closer? No, then I won't do it. And so I had the big goal, and then I would start making the smaller goals, such as, okay, what does that mean for me? Well, it means that I need to be able to master these things physically, technically, mentally, and tactically. Mm. And then I make a priority of it and start going in the short term. So at the moment, this is mentally what I'm working on, and technically and tactically. Mm. And then I take the results that come with it, because my philosophy is that if you have the big goal, mm, and you try to become the person that you can envision as a top 100 player, mm, if you get closer to that as you go along, the results must come. No, mm, if you keep getting closer to the version that you see yourself as a top 100 player, mm, then surely, logically, your results will also start to get in that direction if you get better at it. Mm, mm. And so I was always having the big goal determine my short-term goals, which were more very process-based. I was always very process-based.
Yeah, because continue.
Yeah, that process needs to lead somewhere. So if you're just getting better and better, better, but it was for me, it needed to be something that I can. Yeah, I needed to see myself in that situation, you know. So for me, it was our me and my mental coach, we were always talking about playing at a big court in Wimbledon, you know. What do I need to do to play at a big court in Wimbledon? How do I need to perform? And if I can't do it in a future in England or a challenger in America, then what chance do I have in Wimbledon?
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Yeah. You came into the process there. Did you work anything with results oriented goals or never?
In the beginning, when I was in the national center, but I was just kind of following. It didn't make any sense to me, and as in, it did nothing in my brain. Like, if you, to me, the way my brain works, if you have a result goal, it's, you're a victim of circumstance again. Like, I can technically play the top seed guy 10 weeks in a row and lose and play my best tennis every match, but I don't win. But you know, if everybody could, it didn't work for me because a result goal is nothing you can control. If we could control the results, we would win every time. You know, I want to be top 100 at the end of the year. Okay, great. So do I. Where do I sign? You know, so the way that my brain works was to, I don't understand what that means for my tennis, but what, where do I want to be with my tennis? That I can control more. Like, what am I trying to achieve? How am I trying to react to certain situations? And then I think that gives me the best chance of getting there, when it will be and when it won't be. Yeah. And also, I think one of the dangers of having results-based ambition is that if you then have result-based goals, then your scheduling is after it. So I was always very careful of that, not to play too many tournaments in a row, because if I had to make a certain number of points, then I could just play more tournaments and increase my chances. But one of the things that was pretty clear to me is that it would improve me as a tennis player. So yeah, I play more tournaments. Maybe I win a few futures. Maybe I win some challenges. Who knows? But it doesn't necessarily make me a better player. You know, so if I travel somewhere to avoid it.
So sometimes when you work with process oriented goals, like you say, to improve as a player, it's sometimes tough to measure if you really become better at it. How did you know that you really?
Sure. But there's also never an end point. Like, there's no final destination in sport. So you just keep working, and then you hopefully get better, and then you reevaluate. And if you don't get better, you try to, obviously a lot of it is feel. And but at the same time, if you do get better, your results should get better, you know. So that's also like the part of the, It's not like, sometimes people forget that the process oriented is not to celebrate losing, you know. That's not the point. The point is that in order to give myself the biggest chance of winning points and getting up in the ranking is to be a good tennis player. You know, it's not, I don't think I have a better chance of going to a place where the tournaments are weak and I don't have to beat as good players to rise the rankings. I don't think that's beneficial for my career. I think that I have a better chance of winning next week by trying to play good tennis. I mean, what does it mean if you go in, I'm going to make a good result next week. Okay, great. How? What does it mean? You can't choose to just win. So some weeks you're winning and some weeks you're not winning. What does that mean? And it comes back to where we started with the tiki-taka in Barcelona, you know, what they are not necessarily trying to win, because if it was more important to win that match, maybe they would lump up to the defender in the attack, but they're trying to win, you know, seven championships in the next 10 years. So they know that they can't win every match. Nobody can win every match anyway. I mean, it's impossible.
No.
Even Novak and Rafa lose sometime. Yeah. So I'm trying to see, but what gives me the chance of winning the most matches in a year and not just next week? And I think that's much more important to me too. I mean, it's, and I think that's where sometimes I lose people, and that they think that I don't care about winning. That's not what it means. It's just, I want long-term winning. I want sustainable success. I want to be able to keep winning. I don't want to win next week. I don't want to travel around the world to play weak futures only to get to challenger level and then lose every week because I'm not a better player. You know, I want to be, and that's where I want. I want to keep winning by having sustainable success, by being a better tennis player, not because I took 200 points playing every single week and sometimes having a good draw and sometimes being in places where there are not many good players.
But when you were standing like in the third set 5-all, did you really feel like you so badly wanted to win this match today, for example?
Yeah, absolutely. That's why it's difficult. Mm. It's really, really difficult. Mm. That's why it takes a lot of training.
Yeah.
Yeah. So a lot of my limitation in my career is because I really wanted to win that next match. That's why I took so much training, and also why maybe really being aware of this at 27 was too late. I mean, I still got some good results, but it's really difficult. Of course, I wanted to win because we have this win, you know, fight or flight syndrome that kicks in when we're stressed in the moment. And when it's 5-all in the third set, everything in my body tells me to do whatever it takes to win this match. And sometimes that moment, it tells me to just put the second serve in and hope that the guy misses. But my brain can tell me, yeah, but you know that's not the best chance of winning. But I can fool myself into thinking that is the best chance of winning. And that's why I say what we talked about before, finding a way. Well, the more I get used to trying to win this point on my terms in this situation, the easier it becomes. But if I keep checking out, it's going to be difficult. And how am I ever going to learn? I'm not just going to wake up one day and feel confident to do it. That's not how it works.
No.
Confidence is something that is created based on your actions and your approach. It's not just you wake up one day and feel great today. I'm just going to hit second serve aces at 5-all in the third. That's not how it works. So, And if it were that easy, everybody would do it all the time. No, it's very difficult. It's extremely difficult.
Yeah.
Even the best players in the world find it difficult. They're just a little bit better at mastering it. And that's also why I think the higher up the rankings you go, the more consistent a level you see from the guys, and the more you see them not change their level too much depending on the score, because they're very comfortable with what they have to do. So, and the lower the level, the more you see people change and alter and vary because they're used to this. But the higher the level, I mean, can you honestly tell me that you can see a big difference in Novak when he plays Rublev or Roger or Dominic Kupfer or all these guys? I can't tell a big difference.
No, they're consistent.
So there might be. Yeah, they're just very consistent with what they do. And I think that's a key way to go about. But at the end of the day, it's also very individual what you want to do. Some people don't want to take that step. Some people are comfortable where they are.
Yeah. Yeah.
Some people don't want to make that push. Maybe some people are 50 in the world and very comfortable there.
Yeah.
They don't want to make that push because the risk of this is that you can fail.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, because the in order to give yourself, the way I see it, for me to give myself this chance of really being successful, I have to accept that I will increase the risk of being highly unsuccessful.
Yeah.
So it comes with risk. That's why, but that's also why it's very important that I think you make these decisions when you're calm and collected and you have a big picture plan. So you always know So you always know what is your solution to handling stressful situation and problems. Mm. And what do we do in that situation? And what do we do in this situation? So that, again, that you're always in control of the situation and the situation doesn't control you.
Mm. When you work with the younger players in Denmark now, do you think they have this process oriented mindset?
Yes, to a certain degree, yeah. Mm-hmm. Some better than others, of course.
Of course.
But like I said before, one thing is being aware of it in the brain, and another thing is getting it out in person. And even though I was very, very aware of it in my brain, that would also lead to a lot of conflict, you know, because I could still see in the situation, I'm very aware of what's going on here, but I'm still not physically able to release the handbrake.
Yeah, exactly.
So it takes a lot of training, you know.
Yeah, it's very difficult. Yeah.
It is really, and if everybody could do it, everybody would do it. There wouldn't be any need for coaches. There wouldn't be, because you could just do it. Some are better than others. Some have a natural gift for it.
Yeah.
Some of the superstars, you don't need to do much. You just need to let them go out and do their thing. I mean, I'm sure a lot of the guys, they're very professional, but to a certain degree, they don't really know what they do. They just do it because they're so good at it. The lower they get, the more you may maybe have to micromanagement a little bit to help. Because I could see that with myself, I would overthink a lot, you know. So I need maybe a little more help than a guy who's top 20 would need.
Fredrik, it's been super fun and interesting talking to you.
Likewise.
I really appreciate you taking your time, and good luck in your new coaching career.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Fredrik.
Thanks.
Hi, my name is August Holmgren. I've traveled and been on camps with EuroElite for 8 years. EuroElite has played a major role in my development as a tennis player and a person, and they work with more than 1,200 other players from Denmark, Sweden and Norway during the last 20 years. It all starts with the summer camps, and EuroElite offers 8 different summer camps in Denmark and Sweden in 2022. They're high quality camps with 5 days of more than 18 hours of tennis, fitness, theory and UTR match play with a focus on becoming a better match player. I went to my first summer camp when I was 10, and then my first Tennis Europe Tour when I was 11. After the Tennis Europe Tours, you go on ITF Tours. I've been on pretty much every ITF Tour that EuroElite has to offer, twice. EuroElite also focuses on seeing the culture of the places we go. I remember seeing the great Golden Buddha statue in Thailand and the pyramids in Mexico. Sign up for EuroElite Tours and Camps because they provide 3 things that are essential for the development as a tennis player. A balanced life, a great environment that both challenges and inspires you, and you learn how to have a disciplined mind. It's as simple as that.
Thank you so much, everyone, for listening to this episode. And how fun was that to listen to Freddie Nielsen? The discussion about the process and goal-oriented mindset is super interesting. People are motivated by different things, but I do believe that most of us buy into that we should mainly focus on the process. Sometimes players are motivated more by results, and maybe we coaches should sometimes meet them halfway. I don't know. A player that is driven by a result-oriented mindset and a coach that is super driven by a process-oriented mindset might find some problem in their relationship, and then maybe both of us need to take a step towards each other, is what I have learned and experienced. Thanks so much, Freddie, for taking part in this show, and guys, we talk again soon. And for you listeners that just found this podcast, there's more episodes in English if you scroll back in the library. All right, and visit linuspabaslinjen.com for more interviews, mostly in Swedish though. Thanks for today.